في إمامة أمير المؤمنين علي. Translated as 2,000 proofs for the Imamah of the Commander of the Faithful, Ali, peace be upon him. And is written by the great Shia scholar of the 14th century Gregorian, Allama Jamaluddin Al-Hasan ibn Yusuf Al-Mutahhar, also known as Al-Allama Al-Hilli. Now, many have heard of this specially talented and gifted scholar who has many works on jurisprudence, principles of jurisprudence, theology, philosophy, logic, supplications, and other fields of Islamic studies. He's indeed a prolific author with hundreds of titles. It is said that he was the first to attain the title Ayatollah. Allama al-Hilli's role in bringing Shi'ism to Iran is also documented in the famous story of Sultan Ghiyath-ud-Din Muhammad Khudabandeh. Now, in this book, he presents 1,083 proofs on the Imamah of Imam Ali alayhi salam and the rest of the Imams, peace be upon them. In the introduction, Allama Hilli cites the reason for writing this book. His son, later known as Fakhrul Muhaqqiqin, and his name was Muhammad, asked him to write a book to present evidence for the Imamah of the Imams alayhi salam. After Allama passed away, it is widely reported that he was seen in a dream whereby he was asked how he was. He replied, "I'm very well and in a great state of happiness, mainly for two reasons. Ziyaratul Husayn wa Kitabul Alfayn," i.e. this book. The work shows the extent of his knowledge, expertise and wisdom in presenting this very, very important subject. He utilizes intellectual arguments and rational reasoning, in addition to citation of hundreds of Quranic verses, to categorically establish the need for divinely appointed leadership after the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. For example, at the beginning of the book, he says humans must understand key principles to appreciate and accept imamah. They are summarized as follows. He says the world is created, and the creator is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He is the necessary existent, wajib al-wujud, that has no beginning or end. He is capable of everything and his knowledge encompasses everything. He is not in need of anything. He likes to be obeyed and dislikes disobedience. He subhanahu wa ta'ala has made obligatory for his servants what is best for them and according to their ability. It is also obligatory on him to show lutf, kind compassion, upon them, and hence he sent them his prophets and finally Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Now, his last messenger is error-free and sinless, and indeed delivered the message by the truth.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
The Russell Tribunal on Palestine. By July 1948, the Zionist agency and Haganah had drawn up a plan to drive out the Arabs by using terror to spread fear and encourage civilians to leave their homes without any resistance. The Deir Yassin massacre, which left over 100 people dead, spread panic across Palestinian villages, as the Zionists had intended, and encouraged civilians to flee their homes. Ben-Gurion declared that old Palestinians would die and the young would forget their homeland. Gurion personally directed the obliteration of the Arab past, with Judaized names of streets, villages and towns, and building settlements on 350 destroyed Palestinian villages. But the Palestinian people have not forgotten their Palestine and dream of returning to their homes and land one day. The question that many Palestinians ask themselves today is, has the world forgotten about Palestine and its people? Events such as the Russell Tribunal on Palestine show that the world has not forgotten Palestine or the Palestinians. The first session on Palestine took place in 2010 and was established to examine the role and complicity of third parties such as governments, institutions and corporations in violation of international law committed by Israel against the Palestinian people. Since its creation in 1966, the Russell Tribunal has sought justice when powerful countries turned a blind eye. It demanded investigations when governments tried to hide. And now, the tribunal has reached its final session on Palestine. We are back at Brussels as the jury looks back at the tribunal's work during the last 5 years. The jury is summarizing the findings of the previous sessions, from which it will draw general conclusions. The tribunal's rulings are non-binding and have little more than sentimental value. I spoke to some of the participants at the tribunal and asked why they were taking part and what they felt was the purpose of these sessions.
Monitors the situation in the Middle East. We monitor violations of human rights law and international humanitarian law. We try to mobilize public opinion to make people more aware of the violations of international law by Israel. And we try to give the general public an opportunity to express their feelings and views on the subject of Palestine. I think we all agreed that the situation in Palestine is very serious, that Israel is guilty of serious violations of international law. But the problem is that the United States and the European states are largely unconcerned about the situation in Palestine. And so the purpose of the Russell Tribunal is really to create public awareness of the situation and to try to influence public opinion. And we also call upon the United Nations and states to comply with international law.
We are trying to address a message to the public opinions in Europe, in the United States, in Arab countries as well, and ask them to push to push on their governments where they are, to ask their governments to comply with the international law, and to push Israel to comply with the international law, and to sustain Palestinians to fulfill their rights, in particular the right of self-determination, which is a right which is in the chart of the United Nations.
This tribunal concerns the most critical, unresolved situation of injustice on our planet. Sometimes it seems impossible of resolution, and yet I am very optimistic. Think of what has been achieved, the changes achieved in my lifetime, and indeed I think the lifetime of many in this room, too many perhaps. You know, we have to mobilize the young, as Stefan did with his books, also published in his 90s. We have seen the ending of apartheid. We have seen the ending of colonial rule in Africa. We have seen the fall of fascism in Latin America and indeed in many parts of Europe. We have seen the Berlin Wall pulled down. And these momentous changes happened because of the struggle and sacrifice of the peoples directly involved, aided by the solidarity of ordinary people and their organizations around the world. I am here because I am confident that the oppression of the Palestinian people will likewise be ended.
The tribunal has sought to galvanize international and public opinion in the hope that the international community would put pressure on Israel to cease its criminal activities and respect Palestinian sovereignty. Leila Shahid, the first Palestinian woman ambassador and the official representative of the Palestine Liberation Organization in Europe, shares her thoughts with me on the tribunal.
Of course, a tribunal of citizens. It's not an official one. But, you know, we are in the world of civil society. We have seen a revolution in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Bahrain, in Libya, in Yemen. The world is waking up. We have seen all the people who followed Stéphane Hessel and who made indignatos, you know, indignation in Wall Street, in Spain, in Portugal, in Greece, saying that the citizens also must have their own contribution to the implementation of civil rights, of human rights, and of international humanitarian law. So I think it has an impact because now with the new media, television, internet, the whole world knows the truth. You know, 50 years ago, when they kicked out all the Palestinians, nobody knew what happened. Now people know the truth. And I think that's very important that citizens in the world will also put pressure on their governments, on their elected member of parliament, to make Israel comply with its obligations in relation to the violation of the Palestinian people.
With the Arab Spring in full session, the Arab people are busy toppling their dictators and trying to bring democracy to their countries. Thus, for now, the plight of the Palestinian people is far from the forefront of their minds.
At the time of Barcelona session, we didn't have the Arab Spring. So the 100% of the Arabic countries were led, were ruled by dictators, in fact. People have not been chosen by their people. You know, the leaders were self-designated leaders. And I think that they wanted to keep on their thrones. And to keep on their thrones, they have to obey to the people, the states, the countries, Europe, in the United States, etc. The leaders of the European Union and in the United States ensure them to be seated, to remain seated on their thrones, and they were afraid of their own people. So they didn't have, you know, an autonomy in the decision.
The problem is, of course, there is now a great problem between some of the Arab countries, particularly the Gulf countries, and Iran, because you know that Iran is, and it's legitimate, is a power in this part of the world, like Turkey is, like Egypt is. It's normal. But the Gulf countries consider that the threat that they are facing first and foremost is from Iran. You know that there are problems between a number of Gulf countries, not only on the Persian or Arab Gulf, but also on the fact that in most of these countries there are important Shiite communities living in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait. So they have sort of put Palestine also as a second priority, not as a first priority. Then you have, of course, the Arab revolutions. You have in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, a change, a very important change of government. So also they are thinking of their own internal situation, which is legitimate, so that they are not always available to support or to be very effective in their support of Palestine. They do, of course, at the UN, and this is how we were able to get 138 countries voting in favor, because also of Arab support. But I would say this period for the Arab world is a difficult one. This is why we cannot limit the solidarity to only the Arab countries. We must make it available for all the free people in the world. You saw in this jury, there are South Africans, you have British, you have American Indians, you have Argentinians, you have French, you have Dutch, you have people from all, you have Irish, you have people who are members of a jury who represent the world community of justice and law. And I think this is why they represent also a very important consciousness of the world. You know, in struggles in the world, Unfortunately, very often the governments, the regimes, make compromises because they have interest in oil, they have interest in making alliances with Israel. But when you talk to people who are people of thought, intellectual judges, jurists, then they are the conscious of the world. And I think that Stefan Essel, who was the honorary president of this tribunal, was the best example. But this also is an engine to make third parties in the world, citizens, parliaments, trade unions, churches, also enter the battle to force Israel to respect the Palestinian rights and to put an end to occupation and to accept the fact that the Palestinians have the right to a sovereign, independent state.
The Russell Tribunal has been more than just a simple gathering of citizens who are concerned for the Palestinian people. Far from just being an academic exercise, the tribunal has shed light on the suffering of the Palestinian people caused by the unjust criminal acts committed by Israel. But the plight of the Palestinian people remains the same, a daily struggle for survival under the rule of Israeli occupation. So how much has the tribunal actually achieved? I asked one of the main organizers of the tribunal, Frank Barrett, who has been fighting for justice for Palestine for the past decade, if the tribunal had achieved any of its goals.
I mean, we haven't achieved our goals because our goals are, you know, justice for Palestine, freedom for Palestine, and it's not, you know, it's not happened yet. But this is a long-term goal, obviously, and what we hope the tribunal will have permitted is to create an ever bigger momentum for those goals to be realized. So when we started in Barcelona talking about EU complicity, and when we moved to London about talking about corporations, and then the UN and the US, it was all about, again, empowering us, the people of Europe, North America, people that actually don't have maybe direct links to Israel, Palestine, but to empower us and to make us understand that actually we are all linked and to what's happening on the ground, regardless of our nationality or religious beliefs, and that the situation in Palestine touches us all. We can call it, if you want, the reproduction of the occupation is happening also in various countries around the world. And most importantly, we are not passive actors. We are very active actors because our governments are complicit, because the corporations we buy mobile phones from, shoes from, are also complicit. So it's down to us to stand up to those institutions, to our states and governments, and tell them that, you know, they're not talking in our name.
The tribunal may not have had the power to liberate Palestine and free the Palestinians from a life under occupation, but they have succeeded in putting pressure on international companies complicit in the atrocities committed by the Israeli state. And in so doing, the International Campaign Body for Freedom for Palestine has become larger and more powerful.
The London session, who was focusing on companies who are involved in the occupation, produced clear conclusions condemning these companies, amongst others Dexia, based on a legal analysis of human rights violations, etc., international law, which for us was very important. Secondly, it helped us to make Dexia stop the funding of these settlements. We didn't find any new loans anymore. And so this London session was very useful for that. And just I want to add one thing. The building where we are now for the closing session of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine used to be a building of the Dexia bank. And we were campaigning in the same room as we did now during the General Assembly. So it makes me very happy that this time, in the same building, it's not campaigning against this bank, but it's also a moment of a conclusion of a successful tribunal, which helped the solidarity movement on Palestine to make bigger networks and to make bigger pressure on companies, amongst others.
The London session of the tribunal was especially relevant to this theme of international solidarity. It was about the complicity of private corporations in Israel's violations of international law. We were hearing evidence about companies, some of them are familiar names, operating in our own countries and connected to Israel through a web of affiliates and subsidiaries. private corporations are deeply involved in the three main areas in which international law has been violated: the building of the settlements in Jerusalem and the West Bank, the construction of the separation wall on the West Bank on Palestinian territory, and the incursion of Israeli forces into Gaza in the Operation Cast Lead, inflicting horrendous damage in December 2008 into January 2009. By way of example, and these are just examples, the British-Danish giant G4S, through its Israeli subsidiary G4S Israel, is responsible for the security operations in the military checkpoints at the wall, in the settlements, and in the prisons. The very symbols of oppression are being organized by this British-Danish company. The United States company Caterpillar has supplied the Israeli army with the bulldozers which have demolished Palestinian houses and cleared land for the construction of the wall. The French transport company Veolia built and operated the light rail project in occupied Jerusalem. Significantly, the tribunal wrote to all these companies, and Veolia replied, informing us that it had decided to divest its interest in that project.
The tribunal was about empowering us and make us realize that what's happening in Palestine and Israel is not a faraway conflict, but we are all active actors and we should stand up against, you know, any injustice in the world, in particular in Palestine.
We're entering a new phase at the end of the hearings, the formal hearings. A new phase, and I'm going to, in a sense, declare it as a legal intifada. A legal intifada in which all of you and all of us, whether we're in a formalized body or not, utilize the tools, utilize the international frameworks that are there to bring about change and make a difference, which we know we can do. I'll illustrate how this is in that very short time frame you see up there, really, 2010 to now, barely three years. What has happened in one or two ways? And the intifada that I'm talking about is therefore that Israel is going to be faced with challenges, legal challenges, on all fronts, at all times, from all sides. And those who are imprisoned in Palestine should know that we're out there to support them, to support the rule of law.
The U.S. and the U.N. Continue to support Israel as it commits the most awful crimes against humanity. And of course, the Russell Tribunal, in its strategies for the future, focuses a great deal on the need to utilize the U.N., particularly given the fact that despite the presence of Israel and the U.S., the General Assembly recently accorded Palestine non-member observer state status, which means that Palestine is now in a position, and we support the Palestinians who are calling for this, to join the International Criminal Court, and it can demand standing to bring charges against Israel.
Frank Barrett further explains what conclusion the jury had reached.
As the jury just said, the tribunal in itself, in terms of having sessions every year, is over. We feel we have addressed, you know, the topics we wanted to address. The complicities of various third parties have been thoroughly addressed. We've established that legally we could call Israel an apartheid state. So for us, this is now a time for, we've got the basis, we've got the law on our side, how to implement it, how to make sure people around the world make the findings of the tribunal their finding, then, you know, talk to their governments about it, talk to their families about it, talk to their bosses about it. And the next few months, there's going to be a lot of work in terms of follow-up, going to various countries, going to various solidarity groups, having meetings with them, a brainstorm with them, to try to see how we, as an internationalist movement, if you know what I mean, can make sure justice in Palestine happens.
We had the legal context provided, explaining the Palestinian right to self-determination, nature of this denial by Israel, its relation to apartheid and persecution, the prohibition of apartheid in international law, the law and practice of apartheid in South Africa, as well as an overview of Israeli law and policy with respect to the prohibition of apartheid. These experts defined apartheid relating to the status of racial groups under international law, Palestinian identity and the notion of racial domination, the notion of apartheid as an institutional regime of systematic domination, such as Israel's treatment of the Palestinian.
Of course, we who live in the United States have a very special responsibility to bring pressure on the U.S. government, including President Obama, incorporation of the progressive desires of the planet. And of course, it was important that we were able to elect him president and re-elect him. But now is the time to pressure him to cease his support of Israel and the awful crimes against humanity that it continues to commit.
United States must accept responsibility for the continued expansion of settlements and for allowing Israel to build a colonial empire and to practice apartheid in the occupied Palestinian territory.
This was the one thing Israel did not want. This is the one thing that's now in place. And if you, the Palestinian Authority, do not use the opportunity to go to the court and essentially put Israel on trial for all those things that are mapped out in our various documents, then it is a betrayal. And so therefore we say in no uncertain terms, here we go, Intifada, legal. Thank you.
There you have it. This is the end of the tribunal, but certainly not the end of the struggle, the fight, the campaigning, or the solidarity. In its closing session, the tribunal encouraged people to visit Palestine to witness the daily lives of the Palestinians and agreed a future plan forward, a future that includes an independent, sovereign Palestinian state, free from the shackles of Israeli occupation, and with the Palestinian refugees back in the homes they fled 65 years ago.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In the United States, Republican Senate candidate Blake Masters, who was endorsed last week by former President Donald Trump in Arizona's GOP primary, has admitted that the country is facing a problem with gun violence, but blamed the issue on black people. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Catherine Fong. The article has been published by Newsweek magazine and is titled Trump-backed Senate Candidate Blames Gun Violence on Black People. In the United States, Republican Senate candidate Blake Masters, who was endorsed last week by former President Donald Trump in Arizona's GOP primary, has admitted that the country is facing a problem with gun violence, but blamed the issue on black people, frankly. "We do have a gun violence problem in this country, and it's gang violence," Blake Masters said on an 11th of April episode of the Jeff Horowitz Show, a local Arizona radio show. "It's gangs, it's people in Chicago, in St. Louis, shooting each other. Very often, you know, black people, frankly. And the Democrats don't want to do anything about that." Former President Donald Trump endorsed Blake Masters last Thursday in what was seen as a retaliatory move against State Attorney General Mark Brnovich, who refused to help the former president overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Arizona is a state where the 2020 election was rigged and stolen, and a very thorough audit proved it, Donald Trump said in a statement. "Blake knows that the crime of the century took place. He will expose it and also never let it happen again. It is my great honor to give Blake Masters my complete and total endorsement," Donald Trump said. Arizona's GOP primary won't be held until 2nd of August. The leading GOP contenders are Arizona State Attorney General Mark Brnovich, businessman Jim Lamon, and venture capitalist Blake Masters. Former President Donald Trump officially threw his weight behind Masters on Thursday, endorsing his candidacy in the Republican primary. But recent opinion polls show that Blake Masters is in third place among the GOP hopefuls. Meanwhile, Arizona's Democratic Senator Mark Kelly aims to win re-election this November, as Republicans see his previously comfortably red seat as a key race to win in their bid to regain control of Congress's upper chamber. Mark Kelly managed to flip a longtime GOP-held seat, blue for Democrats, in a special election in 2020. The seat was previously held by Martha McSally, a Republican who was appointed to serve Arizona in the Senate until the special election for the remainder of deceased GOP Senator John McCain's term. Blake Masters, a venture capitalist and president of the Thiel Foundation, is among a number of Republican Senate candidates who have recently pushed the Great Replacement conspiracy theory, a far-right conspiracy theory suggesting that immigrants are being brought into the United States to replace white voters for a political agenda. The theory has inspired a number of mass shootings across the United States. Blake Masters has previously accused the Democratic Party of trying to change the demographics of our country, saying that they hope to import an entirely new electorate. On the Jeff Horowitz Show, Blake Masters called the Democrats light on crime and likened their approach to crime to crocodile tears. "What they mean by gun control is disarming you and me. I'm sure occasionally a ghost gun, a homemade firearm, is used in a crime, but it's pretty rare. Usually it's just a black market handgun," the Senate hopeful said. Masters added, what they do when they ban things like ghost guns, when they ban things like pistol bracers, which they're trying to do, that's all about disarming law-abiding people. Every town for gun safety, a gun control advocacy group, has tracked 84 ghost gun shootings since 2018. In Arizona, Phoenix police recovered 30 ghost guns in 2020 and collected 31 ghost guns in the first 6 months of 2021. Untraceable, DIY ghost guns are the fastest growing gun safety problem in the country. The non-profit Every Town for Gun Safety organization website says they have become a weapon of choice for violent criminals, including white supremacists. And because they can be obtained with no background checks and no questions asked, they are undermining gun safety laws across the country.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayr din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about the rules, Islamic jurisprudential laws about the media, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, They said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching maqasid, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And as always, our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the media, is it permissible, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, to make a movie about Imam Hussein, to portray the story of his martyrdom? You know, especially the principles for which he has sacrificed his life for the sake of Islam, you know. Mind you, the actor who's going to play the part or the role of Imam Hussein is not going to appear in flesh, mm-hmm. obviously. Just a luminous person, like as is always the norm for religious movies, like they don't show the image of the face, the features, right? So, just a luminous personality, good. Right?
Yeah.
Playing the part of the mom. Is it permissible to make such a movie?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If the story of the film is based on reliable sources, with utmost consideration of the sanctity of the subject and the integrity and status of the mm-hmm. Imam alayhi salatu wasalam. So not only the Imams, of course, but his companions like Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas and the household of the Imam. So there is no harm in that, you know. Based on the conditions that you made, because you said that that face is not depicted, and then it's the image is just luminous. There's no objection in it, you know. So it's very much important that the sanctity of the, you know, of the Imam, let's say, or the holy figure is maintained and the utmost care and precaution is exercised in depicting and also narrating the story. Mm-hmm. Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that since it's very much difficult to tackle the subject carefully and accord due reverence to the integrity of the martyred Imam mm-hmm. and his companions, one has to observe extreme precaution in this matter. It's very much necessary to exercise caution or precaution in regards to Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam in narrating his story using a movie, you know. Mm-hmm. And unless, you know, precaution is exercised, it's not permissible to depict the story, because it's very much likely that the picture that is shown on the TV screen may be a kind of considered as a kind of disregard to the Imam and to his companions.
Mm-hmm. Which is not allowed. You also included the companions. Do you mean by the companions? Like close companions or even the remote companions?
No, when we talk about companions, of course, we talk about his immediate relatives,
mm-hmm.
like, for example, Abu al-Fadl Abbas, Ali Akbar, alayhi salatu wassalam, and the immediate relatives who were highly respected by Shia Muslims.
I see.
Not only Shia Muslims, but Muslims, but the entire Muslims, of course.
Yes. Okay, Sheikh Javid, what about Ayatollah Khamenei's view on actors and actresses, in fact, playing each other's part? In other words, like sometimes it is like incumbent on the actors
mm-hmm.
to wear in place of their female counterparts, like the actresses. So they have to wear like women's clothes, all right? Or vice versa, for the purpose of just acting in, either the theater or movie industry.
Right.
What is his view on the opposite sexes mimicking the voice of each other?
Well, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei does not give a definitive answer to this question. He states that it's not, for example, remote to be permissible. So it's not a clear-cut answer. It means that it is very much likely that mm-hmm. it is permissible for the opposite sexes to wear each other's clothes or mimic the voice of each other in acting and expressing the characters of a real person, provided that it does not cause corruption,
mm-hmm.
That's the condition. If it does not entail any corruption or any evil, there's no objection. And as I said, Ayatollah Khamenei does not give a clear cut answer. He says it's not remote,
mm-hmm.
To be permissible. So it's very much, it's likely to be permissible.
Mm-hmm.
So
we also see it in some kind of Islamic passion place, like out in the streets of the Muslim countries. When they want to portray, for example, the event of Ashura,
you're right.
In Karbala, they show like sometimes the men
wearing women's dresses.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, you're right. So that's why Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is completely fully aware of these scenarios, and he does not forbid it.
Mm-hmm.
He does not forbid men wearing women's clothes in such scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
Sure.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. We are talking about the rules of media according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, what is the ruling in the matter of women wearing makeup just for the sake of, performance, as it is somehow necessary or becomes somehow an indispensable part of any kind of film or play for women to wear such makeup? They are like sometimes told by the directors to do so. So what is the ruling regarding that?
You're right, women, sometimes need to wear makeup to present themselves as someone who's quite different from what they themselves appear in their normal life.
Yes.
So, according to His Eminence's ruling, if applying makeup is undertaken by the person herself, mm-hmm. or by another woman, or by one's mahram, and it does not entail any corruption, there is no objection to that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, his Ayatollah Khamenei says that if that's not the case, it's not permissible to wear makeup. And also, His Eminence says that a woman's face with makeup should be covered in front of non-mahram. And this is something, this is a matter of consensus.
Mm-hmm.
All religious authorities are of the view that women should not wear makeup in the presence of non-mahram men. And there is no precaution, there is no ihtiyat in such matters. So generally speaking, women should avoid wearing makeup in places where there are non-mahram men, seeing them with makeup, with ornaments, with things which beautify them. So women should avoid beautifying themselves and showing their beautification to non-mahram men. Of course, in the presence of their close relatives, mahram relatives, there is no objection to them wearing makeup.
But for the sake of the movie, it's completely haram, you mean?
You know, as I said, Ayatollah Khamenei says that if a woman applies makeup,
mm-hmm.
For the sake of, extreme, if there is, it is extremely necessary, and if it does not entail any corruption or any evil, there is no objection to her doing so.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, and thank you, my dear audience, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We say, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.